This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Ernest, what's up? Look, quick question. How is your social battery doing right now? I'll be honest, mine is a bit on the low side. Maybe it's not setting enough boundaries or just a typical slowdown after our super hectic work schedule. It's so easy to overlook our social needs or overextend ourselves, isn't it? What's your ideal balance of socializing? And how do you recharge? Whether you find energy in crowds or need more time to yourself, understanding your social needs is crucial. I remember a time when I struggled to balance my social engagement with my personal downtime. Y'all know us, we're always outside. So what really helped me was learning to recognize my limits and prioritizing my well-being. I've heard plenty of my peers champion therapy as a great tool for gaining this kind of insight. It's not just for big life issues. It's also about enhancing your day-to-day life by equipping you with the skills to manage your social energy effectively. So if you're considering therapy, why not check out BetterHelp? It's an entirely online service, making it incredibly convenient and adaptable to your lifestyle. Just start with a quick questionnaire and you'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And if you feel the need to switch therapists for any reason, you can do so at any time without any extra cost. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/earnyourleisure today to get 10% off your first month. Remember, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/earnyourleisure. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise. And with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
I started doing sabbaticals about 8 years ago. My first one was for a month. And I said, let me see how much they need me. And they can do on their own. I came back. They were good at 85%. So I said, all right, I see what they need to be developed in. And then the next year, I did another one for 2 months. And I'm like, all right, 93, 95%. Okay. And so now they're pretty much 98% in certain things I have to do. So without me being there impactful, I don't have to be there every day. And because they know exactly what to do when they need me, they call me. If I'm unplugged, they know there's a couple of people that can call me. And only a couple people, and that's it. And only if the place is burning down, you call me.
All right, guys, welcome back.
Yes.
This is going to be a super dope episode. You know, we have a lot of ties with the great country of Jamaica.
You don't say.
Of course, Troy is Jamaican.
Big up.
And we had great times in the country of Jamaica. We went to Kingston, and we interviewed Usain Bolt.
Yes.
We interviewed Bounty Killer. We interviewed Shams.
Yeah, we went back to Sherlock Crescent, man, with Shams.
We went to Screechies.
Shout out to Screechies.
Hellshire Parish. Legendary.
Hellshire
Lobster.
Yep.
Amazing. And we've always done stuff like in London, where there's a large Jamaican population, and New York City, of course, Toronto. So we have heavy ties in with the country of Jamaica.
Yeah. Well, you got ties. I got bloodlines. It's different.
So,
he's honorary though. So he eat all our food.
Yeah, he got so, ackee and selfish.
Yeah, all the time. Dumplings. All the time.
I don't really eat the dumplings too much, but the ackee and selfish.
Are you a boiled or fried?
I'm boiled.
Let me see. That's why I knew he was there.
So today we have the wealthiest woman from Jamaica. Is that correct? Is that title correct?
Yes.
Dr. Trisha Bailey, so University of Connecticut alumni.
Yes.
And in the medical field. So has prominent business over 20 years in the medical field. She's the CEO of Bailey's Pharmacy and Medical Equipment Supplies, overseeing a company with massive revenues and employing over 500 people. That's a lot of employees. And I read somewhere where she have like 15 different companies?
I do, yeah.
And just wrote a book.
I did.
You just talked about your son going to school, so proud parent.
I am very
mother
proud.
Five.
Yes.
You can't
mother
five.
Five. Yes.
But we missed a big part. It's Jamaica, bro. You forgot the track part.
Yes.
Of course. I mean, world class athlete from the University of UConn.
Husky.
She's a Husky. We had that. I applied there. I didn't get in. You did apply and became obviously a star and have given a lot back to the university. So congrats on that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I didn't get the track gene. So I am a bit jealous.
you got something else.
Yes, yeah. That's true.
So this is going to be a very high level conversation. We get to talk about your journey from Jamaica to America and athletics and getting in the medical field and growing rapidly. Balancing all of that with being a mother, your new book, being an author. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yes.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Have the Richard Mille on. Nice watch.
You don't say.
It's fake.
Watch busters. Like, I get.
Let me not watch say that because my jeweler might not.
Yeah, no.
Might castrate
me when I leave. Strike that from the record.
That's a fact. All right, so let's start at the beginning. So you're from Jamaica originally before you come to America, right?
Yes.
Like, you were born in Jamaica.
I was.
Because he's technically a Yankee. He's not actually.
You see, he used that word?
Yeah.
Because he know.
He's
an inductee.
Yeah. It's the truth. He's not actually from Jamaica. His parents were from Jamaica. But you're from Jamaica,
I'm
right?
from Jamaica.
Yes. She accepted me, Shadi. Don't do this.
So you grew up in St. Elizabeth Parish.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So the parish, from my understanding, humble beginnings, right? Mm-hmm. How did that shape your perspective growing up in an environment where most listeners that are in America, they don't really have the same appreciation? Like, I went to Jamaica and you see, and Shams took us to his neighborhood and he got the kids computers for the first time. A lot of luxuries that we have in America, a lot of people take for granted. So how was life growing up for you, and how did that shape your perspective?
Well, the way I grew up, we had no running water, no electricity. So therefore, there's no TV or phones or any of the above. We walk 3.5 miles to school each way. The way it built character, it built a thing that I have to overcome obstacles. It gives me the opportunity to build. So I started running track when I was in 10th grade, and I did not know I was good at running. But I ran everywhere because it was faster to get there when I was in Jamaica. So I was practicing what I wanted to become. And when I was able to tap into that excellence, I was like, wow, I'm actually really good at this. And that's how pretty much my humble beginning began.
Yeah. So you leave Jamaica as a teenager.
Mm-hmm. At 13.
At 13, you come to America. And I asked this because I worked in the Bronx, huge population of Jamaican students, but a lot of them were coming to school for the first time. And it's a transition.
It is.
Right? School is something that's taken very serious. A lot of times you're very studious, and then you come to America. What was that transition like for you? Because when I saw it from my students, I'm like, I watched over the course of a year how their personality changed, how their outlook at school changed, how they interacted with adults changed. So what was it like for you?
Oh my goodness. So my mom put me in a school with all Spanish kids.
Where'd you move to?
Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
And well, first I flew into New York, and in Jamaica, they tell you that the roads are paved with gold. And all I saw was dirt and homelessness. And I said, what happened to the gold?
Did they really tell you that?
They really tell us that. And I believed it, but I know why now. So when I started out, when I transitioned, I came to the U.S., she put me in a school. I was the only Black kid in the school. Mm. So I heard all the kids are talking English, and then they switched somewhere else. And I thought I didn't understand the language. I said, oh my God, I don't understand English. And I became extremely quiet. I was painfully quiet. I only talked to one person, which was my teacher, my math teacher. And she kind of gave me hope in progressing. I loved her so much that I wanted to stay in eighth grade. I didn't want to go anywhere else. So it was not an easy transition. Because it's a place where coming from another country and engulfing into a new world is scary. And especially a 13-year-old, your hormones and being a teenager and exploration of self is beginning to happen. Transitioning was definitely not an easy road for me.
So the athletics helped in that, right? Because after your 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, you start running track. How did that help in dialogue between other students, teammates? I guess when you're traveling, you're competing against other people. What role did the athletics play in that transition?
Significantly, because I started gaining confidence and I started finding myself. So when I started running track because I wanted to get away from home. Mm. I started doing sports because I wanted to get away from home. And then I realized that, oh, track, I'm actually really good at this. And so the focus that I gained from walking 3.5 miles and taking care of all the other kids, my cousins and everyone else and aunts, and I used to be the fighter. So I fought for everybody. whenever something happened, they came and got me because they never knew how to fight. So I knew how to fight. So I fought for them. When I came here and started doing track in 10th grade, it kind of brought out my personality. It brought the confidence that I needed to be able to engage with people. One of the other things I also did while in high school, because I was on a junior Olympics team, I had to raise money. So in raising, my parents didn't have it to send me to junior Olympics. So I went to every single door in every neighborhood and I knocked on the door. They gave me quarters, $1, and it kind of started building a confidence level of like, okay, now whatever it is I need, I can go get it. And I continue practicing that.
So, you get good enough where you get a scholarship to UConn.
Yes.
All right. So I'm assuming you're like a All-American in high school.
Yes.
Right. So you catch on to things in America.
Mm-hmm.
You get to college. You're running track in college. Right. At what point do you start to think outside of sports and you want to become an entrepreneur?
So initially I wanted to be a teacher. And I was doing, my undergrad was human development, family relations in concentration, early childhood, because I love children. That's probably why I have 5 of them. And I said, I want to be a teacher because I want to touch children's lives. And my mom said, nope, you can't be a teacher. You're not patient enough. So at this point, I'm like, okay, what am I going to do now?
Ernest, what's up? You ever wonder what's around the next corner? What happens if you push just a little further? With Nissan SUVs, you're equipped to take your adventure to unimagined levels. Imagine the possibilities with a Nissan Rogue, Nissan Pathfinder, or Nissan Armada. Go ahead, find your next big adventure. And while you're out there exploring the unknown, the class-exclusive Google built-in becomes your ultimate co-pilot. No need to fumble with your phone. With Google Assistant, Google Maps, and the Google Play Store integrated into the 12.3-inch HD touchscreen infotainment system of the 2024 Nissan Rogue, your journey becomes seamless. Ask for directions, stream your adventure playlist, or send messages hands-free, all while keeping your focus on the adventure ahead. This just isn't any drive. It's a journey powered by innovation, where the road less traveled isn't just seen, it's experienced. The 2024 Nissan line aren't just SUVs. They're your gateway to adventure, equipped with the tools you need to explore every corner of the world around you. Nissan, dare to do what others don't. Visit your local Nissan dealer or nissanusa.com to find out more and take the first step into your next adventure today.
And I was working at the banks, so I really enjoy finance. I enjoyed investments, and I always found ways to figure out how to save and how to invest my money and all those things, even in high school and as well as in college. So when she told me I couldn't be a teacher, I had this grand plan to get a doctorate degree in education, teach for a while, become a superintendent. And then she said, nope, you can't do that. You're not patient enough. I'm patient with children, not, you know, but I'm not really that patient. So my mom is pretty wise. And after she decided I couldn't be the thing that I wanted to be was a teacher, I started thinking, okay, what am I going to do? And I found myself saying, eventually I want to own my own business, but I didn't know what I wanted to own it in. So I went towards finance. And when I went towards finance, I realized that was where my love was. I love financial development, invest in, and change in my financial trajectory.
So you, out right out of college, after your track career, you become a stockbroker?
Yes.
Talk about that, because, you know, when we think of stockbrokers, usually we think white males.
Yes.
We don't think women. We definitely don't think women of color, and we definitely don't think women that come from Jamaica. So what was that like, getting into that?
So I started applying for jobs after I graduated. And the one company that I said I would not apply to, because I'm like, it's Salomon Smith Barney. It's like the largest brokerage firm in the world, in the country. So they're definitely not going to call me back for an interview. And at the time I was married, and my husband said, just send a resume, and I'm faxing. And they were the only company that called me back. And it was for a meeting planner at a national training center. So I'm there, and I'm at work. And every day I was early, and I was always late because I didn't know that you're supposed to go home at 5 o'clock. I was like, there's a project I have to do, so I'm going to finish it. And so the national director said, he walked by me and says, you're always here. Didn't think that anything of it, because I'm like, I have to finish my work. It's their leave, but I guess they finished their work, so I have to finish mine. And about 2 months into it, I realized that all the brokers were coming in for training. I'm like, I could do what they do. I mean, they're making a lot of money. And I decided to apply for the stockbroker job. Did not know there's an inter-office protocol that you're supposed to go tell your boss that you're applying for a job within the company. So when I applied for the job, they called me in the office. The national director called me in the office, and he said, I didn't know that you wanted to be a broker. And I said, yeah, I think that I can definitely do it. And he said, if I knew that, I would have been training you along. And so when he said, you definitely have the potential to do it. And he started training me. And then I had the interview, which was gruesome. It was grueling. And they hired me, and I became the youngest broker in the company and the only Black woman in New England for Salomon Smith Barney at the time.
At 22.
So when did you start getting in the medical field?
Right now, so I wanted to have children because I've always had the love for children. And I knew I wanted to start having kids, and working as a broker, it wasn't conducive to that. I was in the office at 6 a.m., leaving at sometimes 1 o'clock in the morning. And so I decided to transition to the pharmaceutical industry because it was easier. It was more 9 to 5, manage your accounts and go home.
So you started as a sales rep?
As a sales rep.
For a pharmaceutical company?
Yes.
Selling medical equipment?
Medical supply. No, I was selling products, like pharmaceutical products, medication.
To doctors?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't need a degree for that though, right?
You
have to be licensed?
They will only hire you if you have a degree.
Okay.
Yeah. You don't need a degree for it, but you're not getting hired if you don't have one.
Just a college degree though.
There's no
specific degree for that.
Yeah.
So, all right. So now you're selling. Okay. So now you go into selling stuff to doctors. You're going all across to different doctors in your network, and you're trying to pitch them, and you're like waiting for them to get out of surgery, stuff like that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the process.
Yeah.
I know a few people. So you become successful in that?
Yes.
You like rise up the ranks?
I did.
Top salesperson type person?
I was the number one and number two. I was with the first company. I was number one. I was there for 3 years. And then I went with the second company. I was back and forth one and two for the 8 years that I was in the industry.
What was your sales thing that made you outstanding? Because sales is extremely difficult. Like, what did you do to make sure that you were successful?
I built relationships. So I got to the point where I knew that the first 6 to 8 months, I gun it as you can imagine. So I was there 8 o'clock in the morning. I didn't leave until 6 p.m. which is really long hours for a pharmaceutical salesperson. Because I knew once I built a relationship with the doctors, now I didn't have to work so hard. So now I call them on the cell phone and say, hey, I'm coming by. And they say, all right, come through the back door. Where most sales reps, they will have to wait for an hour, and then it'll take you forever to see people. Where in my day, I can see 20, 30 doctors because I had relationships with these people. And that's just building relationships. And sales is pretty much building relationships.
How did you build the relationships?
My financial background. Most doctors aren't really business-oriented people. Mm-hmm. They're not investors. Mm-hmm. So they always wanted to have conversations with me about their portfolios, what they're investing in, how to invest. And then I started, you know, I was doing a lot of real estate flips at the time. And they were always asking me, so what next? What's next? And so that's how I built. And I ended up becoming friends with most of my doctors. To the point where my partner, she said to me one day, she said, all the doctors love you. I have like two. And you have like all of them. Mm. And it's simply because I know how to maintain relationships, build them, and be able to bring value. And I think bringing value to every person's lives, whether it's your friends, your family, whether it's someone you work with, or someone you're simply engaging with, it makes a ginormous difference in the places that you'll go.
You sound like, I mean, obviously you've been successful at each level, whether it was from athletics, when you were a stockbroker, to pharmaceuticals, and then to the medical equipment. What made you transition from being in finance to being in pharmaceuticals, right? Was it an issue of like, this isn't what I want to do, this is not the path I want to continue going? Was it a financial decision? Like, there's more opportunity for me to make more money in this field? Like, what was the deciding factor to say, I'm leaving this behind, I'm going to start something different?
I wanted to start having children.
Okay.
And I knew that I didn't have time.
The time.
Gotcha. To be able to give to children, because being a broker is not conducive to that. And then the other reason was, as a broker, you have to go find your clients. You got to qualify them. You got to be able to determine within 30 seconds or a minute if this person have money or are they going to waste your time. In the pharmaceutical sales, they give you the clients. So I'm like, they give you the clients. That's all. And that was like a slam dunk, because if I get the clients, I can sell to the clients. And so those were my reasons for transitioning.
Gotcha.
Oh, you didn't have to like cold call? You had a book of business that was given to you?
It was, well, it's not a book of business, it's the clients. So these are the doctors who prescribe XYZ, and whether I'm launching a new drug or they're specific to, like, I was a cardiopulmonary specialist when I finished. So cardiologist or pulmonary. And they give you those clients. So you go and see them and you give them all the details. One of the methodologies which I used is I always find studies that were outside of the drugs that I was selling, so that they were value. I brought more value to just than simply just talking about the drugs that I was selling. And we end up having stimulating conversation in reference to the disease state and how to benefit the patients and why they should use it. And so those were the difference between myself and I believe some of the other salespeople.
So, all right. So after that, then you get into your own business?
Yes.
So walk us through that.
So I got promoted every year. So every December seemed like that was my month. And so December is my month. I got promoted to various things. And the last promotion I had was in California. So at the time, I had finished my master's in business administration, and I was in the process of finishing my doctorate. Usually when you're promoted, they interview you. They decided not to interview me because of I was number one in the company. I was rep of the year. I was rookie of the year, blah, 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 blah. And the manager hired me based on my accolades. I got to California. He approved everything. I got to California. He looked at me. We had lunch. And he says, oh, I didn't know you were Black. And I said, oh, yeah, I am. I didn't think anything of it because the company had been amazing up in this point, and I had not experienced any level of racism at this point. So I was like, okay. Right after that, in less than a day, he started disapproving all the things that were approved for me to move and transition. And when he did that, when he started doing that, I was like, why am I working for someone when I have all these degrees and I want to start my own business? I didn't want to start it while I was doing my doctorate because I knew it would have been more difficult. But he forced me to get to the point where I started it. So I started a medical recruiting company because I said, I know doctors and I know how to place them in different jobs. And so I started that business when I transitioned. And so that was my first business.
And what was the first business?
Medical recruiting.
Medical.
What does that entail? Like for the audience who may not understand what that actually means.
So basically, I was a headhunter. So I would contract with hospitals, medical practice across the country, and I would find them doctors to fill the roles for the hospitals or the medical practices. And I'll negotiate their contracts. I schedule site visits to there and negotiate the contract, make sure that the employer and the employee are happy, and then they transition.
And then you get a piece of that.
And then I get a fee for it.
Like 20%, 10%?
Sometimes it's percentage. So sometimes it's range between 20 and 30%. But most of medical recruiting is usually between 20,000 and 50,000 per placement, depending on the specialty.
What age are we at this point?
At this point, we are at 30.
At 30?
Yeah.
All right. So we're at 22 with the Young Stockbroker. At 30, we started our own business. Starting to become lucrative. Pretty lucrative.
Yes, yes.
How are you, I mean, you've always been, it seems, pretty disciplined with money. How are you now handling with the success of having money and having it around, I guess, people, you know, especially from our culture, who are not used to having money and definitely having family members who don't have it? How are you dealing with that?
Then or now?
Then.
Well, then.
Now. We're going to get to now.
Then there was, I didn't, if I have, the way that I, and I'm like this right now.
Yeah.
I could have 200 accounts.
Yeah.
There's one account that matters. If that account is low, I don't have any money. I've always been like that. So if something goes in an investment account, it means it can never be touched. It touched only to change the investment vehicles, but not to be touched to spend. And so during that time, I was broke. I was making $800,000 a year plus, but I was still broke. That wasn't enough money for me to spend. And I drove a moderate car. Obviously, I own a house because you have to invest in making sure you own a home. And I drove a Camry and they were like, you should buy a Benz. I'm like, for what? I don't want to buy a Benz. You buy a Benz, which is my dream car, when I have my dream house. And the dream house must come first and then the dream car comes second. And so I've always had that mind frame.
And I like that. I got 800,000 and I'm broke. It's a mentality. It's like when we talk about people changing their zero, right? A lot of people's zero is like when they have no money in their account.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will say, like, if I have $2,000, if I go anything less than that, I'm broke. You started your, like, was it always that goal? Like, if it's $800,000 or it's $1 million, like, the goal was always to have that level as the broke?
Not really. I mean, right now, I still don't think I have enough money.
Interesting.
I've always got to have that mind frame. There's, like, I feel like there's so much more that I could always do. The way that I have been with money, just extremely disciplined when it comes to, and I knew investment. So I knew how to invest it, what to invest in, how to invest it. For example, when I was in the pharmaceutical industry, they were paying for my degrees. So what I did, I took my student loans and I flipped houses during the market when it was doing great. So I made a lot of money during that time. And every single dime I make goes to my investment account. Nothing was ever spent. I've never spent, when I was a broker, a commission or bonus, which was most of all, pretty much almost all what you make. When I was in the pharmaceutical industry, there was never a bonus was ever spent because it's bonus. It's supposed to be saved. It's supposed to be invested for later on. And so I've always kind of held that, and I've been like that from when I was little.
So, okay. So you're doing good with the recruiting business. How long is that your main focus before you start another business?
So the reason, so I started the second business because I wanted something tangible, something that if I'm not working, like right now, I'm not working per se, it can still make money for me. And I was in a coma in 2008. And during the transition from, I was in California at the time, during the transition from California to Florida, I wanted to be home with my family. And
why were you in a coma?
You have to read the book for that. Okay. That's one of the tell-all in the book.
So yes. Got it.
So when I was transitioning, I was wheelchair bound. My larynx was clipped, so you could not hear me speak. And the flight attendant escorted me off the aircraft and placed me in a corner. And I waited there and I was there for 3 hours trying to signal someone because they can hear me talk. And I cried and I saw people just kept walking by me, and I tried and tried and you cannot hear me. And finally, a young girl came over and she helped me. And when that happened, I realized that the disabled was not cared for. They were invisible to the world. And after I recovered from the coma, I decided to start a medical equipment business because I never want anyone else to feel the way that I did.
So what is medical equipment? What does that actually entail?
wheelchairs, hospital beds, respiratory, CPAP, oxygen, diapers.
So you're buying these things and selling them?
Yes. So I buy them from the manufacturers.
So you buy them from like China?
No, I buy them from U.S.-based manufacturers.
All right, a U.S.-based manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And you're selling them to hospitals?
Hospitals, I also sell them to patients. So let's say, for example, mom is in the hospital and she cannot ambulate. She cannot walk. So they will send us over a prescription for a wheelchair and a walker. And we'll qualify them through their insurance, through Medicare or whatever insurance they have. We'll build the insurance. Now they qualify. They haven't received one in 5 years, so they qualify. And then we deliver it to the patient's home. We set it up. We make sure that the wheelchair gets through the doorways. We make sure that there aren't any obstructions so that they won't fall. And we service the patient for a year thereafter.
So
how cash intensive is that? Because when I'm thinking, if I'm trying to start this, how much money would I need to start like a home health care medical
equipment? Well, that's not really home health care. That's medical
equipment business.
So you have to have 700. Well, when I started, the number may have changed now. Yeah. So I haven't ventured back in that area yet recently. When I just started, you have to have 700,000 liquid in order to start the medical equipment.
So the medical equipment, are you ever physically holding or are you just shipping it from the warehouse to the client?
So you have a physical. So I personally have a physical hold in. So all my deliveries are done by drivers that's within my office that I hired, and they're employees of Bailey's.
And you have a physical warehouse?
Yes. So every location. So right now I have 16 locations, and every location has at least one or two warehouses that stack with items that patients would need. So if the prescription comes in today and they need walker, wheelchair, they will qualify the patient, send it out for tomorrow delivery.
But you're not making any of this stuff?
No, I'm not making.
So, all right, that's interesting. I would have thought that the people that make it are the people that sell it. So if it's like X, Y, and Z wheelchair, right? Like these are the manufacturers of it and they're selling it. Like BMW sells cars that they make. Why are they not doing that? And why would a hospital just not buy directly from the people that's making it, as opposed to, you're essentially like a middleman in the situation, right?
Right.
Why would there be a need for a middleman?
So because the part of qualifying the patient and servicing them because disabled people, you have to service them. You have to make sure that they're set up properly, make sure that they're not going to fall, make sure they're not returning to the hospitals. So the manufacturers, they would have to create a whole nother division in order to service the patients. And so that's why the middleman is necessary. Most manufacturers do not sell directly to a hospital, some of which do sell to hospitals, however.
Okay.
So, but not to end stage patients.
So you like customize the situation?
Yes.
To make sure they're getting the right fit. They just make a million of them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to like make sure that this one fits this person. And
right.
They might need to tweak a little bit here and there.
Yes.
Type situation.
Exactly that. So like a wheelchair. So, you know, wheelchair people are different sizes. So my staff have to qualify the patient to make sure that, okay, they might need a K1. A K1 is a standard wheelchair. And they might need it. They might be 200 pounds, 5'8", but they might be bottom heavy. So instead of them having a 20 inch, they might have an 8 or 18 inch. They may have a 20 inch. So that's what is necessary for someone like myself in the middle.
So, I mean, because technology changes, so you have to keep up with the technology, especially with wheelchairs. Like 10 years ago, they don't look the same. They're not operating the same. How do y'all handle compliance and regulatory issues when it comes to the equipment?
So there are the medical equipment industry is actually more regulated than even pharmacy.
Right.
You would think that it would be the other way around.
I read that.
But you have to be licensed in each state. Then you have accreditation. Then you have Medicare. Then you have all the other insurance plans. And then you have oxygen is separated from the medical equipment. And you have oxygen license. So there in each location, there are at least six, sometimes seven licenses that you have to have.
Just to sell the equipment?
Just to sell medical equipment.
Wait, which state did you start in Florida?
Florida, yeah.
So which states are less regulatory, right? So I'm assuming Florida probably would have been the easy state to do it, and not easy, but in the sense of like not having to deal with as much as you would in other states. What states that come to mind are like, all right, this is a good state to create this business in?
So it's really governed by Medicare.
Okay.
Which is national.
Right.
And you have to follow Medicare guidelines in all states. And in order to bill Medicare, which is all equipment patients, mm-hmm. Disabled patients, you have to follow the guidelines. So it's really now easier in any state. Florida, I think, is a little bit harder. They take longer for the license. They're more, they cost more for the license. And it's because the reason why accreditation came into play is because what I've been told is Florida and South Florida was one of the places that they had the most Medicare fraud. There were places, people that were just picking up buses of people, pay them $100 and just bill the insurances from what I heard. Now, that may not be factual, but that's what I was told.
So when, okay, so what's the profit margins?
The profit margins are good. They're good. It depends on what the items are. Some of them sucks. Some of them are not that great, but most of the times you'll get a patient who, let's say that they're bedbound. They need a hospital bed. They need a lift. They need a commode. They need a walker. They need a wheelchair. And so a lot, sometimes they need oxygen. So with a patient like that, which is a lot of our patients, you'll find that there's a really good profit margin, because even if you don't make a lot on the hospital bed, you might make a decent amount in the wheelchair, and it'll kind of offset each other.
So you're selling multiple things.
Yes.
So, and yeah. you said Medicare. So when you're selling this stuff, you're like a doctor, like you're billing insurance for it?
Yes.
People aren't paying out of pocket.
Well, sometimes.
Well, a lot of it's coming from insurance.
From insurance, yeah. Yeah.
How does that process work?
So when we qualify, so you have to, if for wheelchair or any, really any medical equipment, if you have Medicare as a primary insurance, you cannot get one. You could only have one per 5 years. So my staff are running through the system. Okay, this patient received one last year from this practice, and maybe they got billed for 2 months. You can take over the billing for that patient and give them another one because they returned it. Or if it's a patient who actually do qualify, you will just bill for the 13 months. So it's a 13-month rental for most equipment. If the reason why it's profitable is because if a patient passed away or goes in the hospital or no longer need it, you pick it up because they're rentals, then you re-rent the same item to someone else.
Did the, I guess the relationship.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand, and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
Save big money at Menards. Let the fresh air in and keep the bugs out with replacement screen for your doors and windows from AdForce. It's easy to install, durable against the elements, and comes in a variety of types to suit your needs. Repair your screens today with a roll of replacement screen on sale through May 5th. And check out more great deals happening now in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
That you build when you were doing pharmaceuticals play a key role in obviously creating for the medical help equipment? Because I'm thinking to myself, how would I get the patients? I'd have to have a relationship with some of these hospitals. So what role did that play?
Not much. The relationship between my medical recruiting, because of my strong relationship with the practices, mm-hmm. that had somewhat of a role in it. But my first hire was a salesperson, which should be every business first hire should be a salesperson. I was out selling and I was coming back, processing the order, delivering the items. And I walked into a facility and I said to the director, I said, I want a pretty white boy. And she said, I don't know anyone. What up? You know, hold on. The director's son, he just graduated. He's selling grass. Maybe you can talk to him. And my head, I said, director's son, the director of rehab. That's over three different rehab centers.
Yeah, need
that's
him.
A lot of equipment that's coming my way. I'm like, I'll interview him. And in my head, I said, even if he's semi-decent, I'm hiring him because I'm getting those sales.
Put him to work.
And I did. I hired him. And he, my first employee, was still my right hand today.
Interesting. Yeah, you got an eye for it. So what, because the equipment that takes to make these, have you ever run into issues with supply chain?
Right. I did not. Most people did during COVID.
Right.
I did not have supply chain issues because God just happened to give me this amazing brain. As soon as COVID hit, I have a warehouse on my ranch and it's about 7,000 square feet. I ordered everything that I could, stocked it from to roof. And because of that, I didn't have supply chain issues because I had all the equipment and supplies that I needed.
So you said that you have 15 locations?
I have 15 locations, yeah.
15 warehouses.
I have probably 25, 26 warehouses.
So what's the location then? What's the location? What is it? What is the location? Like, what would be a location? Because I'm thinking a location is the warehouse.
Oh, no. The location has a physical office that has a display floor and it has the staff that stays in that. And the warehouses are where we just store the supplies.
The location, because people, it's not like a walk-in thing, right?
It is.
A walk-in?
You can, yeah.
You can walk in?
You can. Most people can't walk in, so we deliver, but yes, you can walk in.
So at a location, you have people calling people?
Mm-hmm.
And you have, what's at a location?
So at the location, so when you walk in, first you're going to see pharmacy because most of my locations have pharmacy. You'll see a display of medical equipment on the floor with a hospital bed, Hoyer lifts, commodes, wheelchairs. Then you'll see staff that are there processing the orders, answering phones, and scrubs because scrubs is also another part of my brand, of my line. So pretty much that's, and then you have sometimes my warehouse is on site. Sometimes they're offsite. So that's what a location usually looks like.
It's crazy that you're saying this because I'm just thinking I drive past a location, not yours, in my down the street from my house every day. And I'm not going in because it's not, but I'm like, oh, wait, that does exist.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I want to know how competitive this is because you're doing it, but I'm sure there's other people that are trying to compete and get these clients and have more customers. How competitive is it in this space?
It's competitive. It's very competitive. However, I don't look at my competition. Why? Because I'm better than everybody else in the industry. The reason why I'm better, the reason why we're better is because we service. See, in the medical industry, service is usually not very great. And because I had personal experience of not being cared for, I require that from my staff. They know that the one reason that they can get fired for without a question is if they're nasty or unkind to one of my patients. Mm. And because of that, I make sure that they have honey cones on their lips. When you answer my phone, I don't care what mood you're in. You must have honey cones on your lips. And they know that. And because I also treat them well. I treat them so well. So that, matter of fact, on my birthday, this past birthday.
Happy belated.
Thank you so much. I plugged into the chat, the company chat, and I said, okay, guys, it's my birthday today and I have something for you. So I gave, for the last 2 years, I gave all of them, the entire company, $1 per hour raise. And so a lot of the employers are messaging me like, who gives someone something for their birthday? I do, because I believe that you should be kind and loving to every person who is taking care of you and every person who's around you. And I treat them extremely well. So every customer that engages with them, I get amazing reviews. And I got the opportunity to experience it organically for myself. The delivery drivers, when in their processes, the managers don't tell them they're coming to my house. So if I have medication being delivered, my mom get her medicine, they'll call and they have no idea they're talking to me. And it felt so good. He was so polite and so kind, and his voice, his tone was so loving. And he had not a single clue that he's talking to me. And I said, this is exactly why I do what I do for my staff.
So how'd you get into the pharmacy side?
So the pharmacy side, initially when I started out, I was in a smaller space, 600 square feet. Then I moved. I had to move because we're growing and we're getting bigger. I moved into pretty much a rat trap. It was like rats and roaches everywhere, but it was large and it was space enough that I needed. I had 3 children at this time.
This is for the equipment still?
No, this is while the equipment, yeah, for the equipment. So I had three children at the time. I'm at CBS, and my son, who seemed to predict my future, the one I was talking about, my freshman in high school right now, he said, "Mom, why don't you get one of these?" And I looked at him. I said, "You always think so highly of your poor old mama." And a year later, he told me I should do it, and I did it. A year later, I was opening my first pharmacy.
What was the thing that he said, "You should get one of these"? A pharmacy.
I should get one of these. So on a CVS.
Like a CVS.
Yes.
So what was the process of opening your pharmacy?
So the process was, first I had to hire a pharmacist, which is, you know, pharmacists make a lot of money. And that, so I found the first Black pharmacist that's in the area. He was not working at the time. He's older. And so I had to negotiate his salary all the way down because I didn't want to spend a whole bunch of money while I'm trying to get to a space that I need to be in. And so you got the buildings built out, everything, all the structure in place. Then you apply for a state license. And then after state approves you, then you apply for DEA, and then you go through an interview process. And then at this point, then you can order the drugs that you need.
And that was in Florida?
That's in Florida.
And the first pharmacy was in the equipment?
Yes.
Same location?
Same location.
So you just thought that you could just, it would just make sense to open a pharmacy because you're already doing medical equipment?
Yes. So my thought process with that, medical equipment, my patients are homebound, most of them, most of which are on medication. So pharmacy, the way that I do all business, one has to feed the other. I don't do anything independently. I stay in my lane. So medical equipment feeds pharmacy, pharmacy feeds medical equipment. I later added scrubs, because the providers are the ones who refer the business over to me. And then, so when they come in to look for the scrub really don't make much money. But then they can see that we have pharmacy, we provide great service, we have medical equipment, and those are the people who brings in. So now I have three businesses that is in one location with one overhead, not three separate overheads.
So you're just like a one-stop shop?
Yes.
There's 15 businesses though.
Yes.
I'm thinking if there's three in one. Well, I got a couple of questions. The first thing, are the medical equipment, are they renting that equipment or are they owning that?
Most are rentals. So if they go through insurance,
yeah,
most are rentals. You bill as rentals. After 13 months, then they own it outright.
After 13 months?
Yes.
Okay. And the second part is 15 businesses. How are you managing time, right? Because you got your mother, you got these businesses, they're lucrative. How are you managing time throughout this process? Like, you know what I mean? Because I'm thinking to myself, yeah, one business, my son says, "Hey, I should get a CVS." I'm wondering if I walk into CVS the next time my son will say that. I don't know. Right? And he's just like, I can imagine you seeing things and you're saying, "All right, I think I can do that." Like, how are you acquiring businesses? How are you managing time?
I don't know how managing time, really just God, because that's the only thing I can think of. I came home from Greece, when was it? Sunday night. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to manage spending time with the kids. They got to have their tea time and their story time every night at 7 o'clock. And I'm on the phone with such and such and I'm doing this. I don't know how I do it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I only select things that are important that can move my needle. If it doesn't move the needle, there's no reason for me to be there. I don't do a lot of networking now because there's not really a lot of need for me to do a lot of networking events. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not doing a speaking engagement, I'm really not showing up at an event because the time that I have is for the children. Yeah. And I love the time that I have with them. So those are my personal time and that's how I manage it. And I have an amazing staff.
Yeah.
So all right. So this pharmacy situation, what's the business model behind this? So you buy the drugs, mm-hmm. right? From where you buy drugs from?
Our wholesale, different wholesalers. So you have Cardinal, you have McKesson. My specific wholesaler is McKesson.
So these are like just labs that just make drugs?
They're wholesalers that buy it from the pharmaceutical company, and then they sell it to the distributors like us, like Bayley's Pharmacy.
A pharmaceutical company makes drugs. Merck and Merck. These companies mm-hmm. make, they Pfizer. Make drugs. Pfizer, they make drugs. Mm-hmm. The distribution company buys it from Merck and Pfizer.
Yes.
You, on the retail side, buy it from the distribution company.
Yes.
Client, personal clients and doctors buy it from you.
Correct.
Correct?
Correct.
That's the chain of events.
Yes.
And everybody's making money in between this whole situation.
Yes.
Okay. So you get licensed. You have to get all the certification, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. And now you're buying these drugs, right? Now, who's the main source of revenue? Or is it walk-up clients, or are you selling to doctors and hospitals?
I sell to both. So I have a government division that sells to, and the government division covers the hospitals, skilled nursing facilities, practices, and then I have the pure retail customers. So the clients that come over from doctor's office, the doctor sends over that patient needs Prozac. Then we process the order, we deliver it to the patient. So that's pretty much the methodology in which we use.
So 30, I stopped at the age, right? Because I know at 35 is a big number. 35 is a big number, and there's a big word that is attached to that. I don't want to use the word, but on our phone call, you did say the word billionaire.
You did.
You did say that. I did. And I thought it was important that you said it because I want people to feel inspired that is something that's attainable. And kind of the reason when we spoke, I said, your story needs to be told. Young ladies need to hear it. Young men need to hear it. Especially young women from the islands need to hear it, that there's somebody that is super successful at what they're doing, and it has nothing to do with athletics. Like growing up, you hear Michael Lee Chin and you think that's it. And I'm like, no, there's somebody else. So as you're approaching this number, I mean, what is that like, right? You're seeing the revenue come in, you're super disciplined when it comes to finance, and you're approaching a milestone that very few reach, especially that look like us. What's the mindset as that's approaching?
So money has never been my focus, believe right. it or not. Even though I'm super disciplined with it, it's always been about the next thing. What is the next thing that I could be great at? Mm-hmm. What is the next thing that I can do to help someone or to build my portfolio? So when I learned that I became a billionaire.
You didn't even know.
I did not know. I knew I was getting close, but I didn't know that I was there. And so I was standing in my closet and my trust attorney called and I said, I need to get you to do da da da. And he says, honey, I'm no longer able to service you. And I said, why? He says, well, your net worth is over $1 billion now, and you need someone else that deals with extreme high net worth individuals. And I was like, oh, okay. And that was my response. It didn't move me because there's greater cause. My job and my role and the reason why God has chosen me to be in this place is to help other people. And it kind of comes right back to teaching. So I'm in the role of teaching now, even though my mom said I could not teach, but I teach in a different capacity now. And my scholarship kids are near and dear to my soul mm-hmm. because they're all young girls, young women, and I have some males as well that look like me mm-hmm. who are striving for greatness. And I believe my role in their lives and in most women's lives is to help them to elevate to the next level.
That's amazing. I want to talk about this quest that you're on the philanthropy side, but I want to go back to the business if we can for a minute. Pharmacies. How many pharmacies do you have?
At the moment, I have 7, and I'm in the process of opening 6 more.
So what's more lucrative, the pharmacies or the equipment?
The equipment.
The equipment?
Yes.
That's the bread and butter?
Yes.
Pharmacies are like side dish?
Yes.
Side dish, appetizer, like big side dish?
It's big side dish.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Scrubs is like asparagus.
We might touch that. Okay, gotcha.
So the plans of scaling, is it the primary focus is scaling equipment business?
There's not necessarily my, so I always, whenever I am scaling up, I always started with medical equipment first. And initially what I did was I always made sure medical equipment was making money that can afford pharmacy because someone have to pay the bill and it wasn't going to come from Florida store when New York is operating. So I started medical equipment. It's making money. Now I open pharmacy and add to it. Now I just open both because the company is making so much money now. So it's always medical equipment first, add pharmacy and scrubs at the same time. So that's pretty much what the methodology in which I use now.
Is there another, I guess, something in the supply chain? You got the pharmacies, you got the medical equipment, you got scrubs. Is there another piece that you're looking at? Like, oh, we can add that to the portfolio and really just blow this thing out the water?
Yes. So there's another huge piece, actually. The first big piece is I actually own my pharmaceutical company, which makes the generics. So the generics are, instead of buying these generics from another wholesaler, I make them myself. So our profit margin are significantly more. The other part that's huge is my real estate side. So I buy the building. Usually it's multi-tenant. So the tenants would pay the mortgage if there's one. And I rent the space from my company to my other company. And so that's one of the, that's the biggest part. And my real estate portfolio is the biggest part of my portfolio.
So all of the buildings that you have, you own?
Yes.
And you said you have 15 businesses?
Yes.
What's the other ones?
So I have real estate development. I have two real estate companies. I have the equipment, pharmacies, scrubs. I have three different aviation business. I own oil wells. I own a bunch of oil wells, actually. And I guess I do own this, but I don't consider it one of my business. I'm a part owner in three different NBA teams. It's just an investment thing.
Three?
Yeah.
Can you say the teams?
I can.
Well, which teams?
Well, I mean, I can't walk in and be like, I'm a part owner of your team.
In it,
right. So Atlanta and, hang on, Atlanta, P-Tan, where is she? My assistants, I can't remember what the other two are.
Orlando Magic?
No, no, honey, I don't own the Magic. I want to buy them, though, but I don't own them. Phoenix and Charlotte.
So you say you're part owning three teams. How?
Minority owners.
Through who? Through.
So there is a way that they have to invite you in to be an investor, and you are a minority owner. So I was invited in a few years ago to be an investor.
So you can be an investor in multiple teams at one time?
Yeah. Minority, that is.
Minority?
I'm sure you can probably own multiple teams at one time too.
So what's the oil? You said an oil well?
Oil wells.
What's the oil well thing about?
So oil wells, when you invest in different oil wells or buy oil wells, it's a major tax benefit. So if let's say that I spend $2 million in one oil well, I get 75% tax deduction from there. So that's how I started owning oil wells. I also owned a building in Dallas, that well Fort Worth, that has oil under the building. And I'm in the process of closing another one that also is.
Where are these oil wells located?
The ones that I invest in, the one I specifically own directly, the other investment, the other 50, because there's 50 others, they're all over the country. They're in various places. I've never
been. The one that you own directly?
In Fort Worth.
In Texas.
Fort Worth, Texas.
You said oil's under the building?
Mm-hmm.
And so you own the building, and then there's oil under it, so you can write off the building because it's, how's that work?
So I rent this out to like Shell, and then they will drill oil, and then they pay you for drilling it.
Okay. Got that. The pharmacy business, the medical equipment business, is that domestic or does that expand outside of just the United States?
So the equipment is U.S. and international. So I have begun discussing outfit in various hospitals in different countries. Mm-hmm. Like, well, U.S. Virgin Islands is one of the places, and I mean, this is U.S. based. Mm-hmm. Jamaica. I've had conversations in the Bahamas. I haven't done any business there yet. Yeah, mm-hmm. No.
Yeah, because I mean, global expansion is that on the horizon?
We'll see how tired I get.
You're not running all of these companies?
I am.
You're running all these companies?
Mm-hmm.
So how you manage to run all of those companies?
I have people like this beautiful young woman sitting over there. I have an amazing staff. Like when I say amazing, amazing. My executive team, I started doing sabbaticals about 8 years ago. My first one was for a month. And I said, let me see how much they need me and they can do on their own. I came back. They were good at 85%. So I said, all right, I see what they need to be developed in. And then the next year I did another one for 2 months. And I'm like, all right. 93-95%, okay. And so now they're pretty much 98% in certain things I have to do. So without me being there impactful, I don't have to be there every day. And because they know exactly what to do when they need me, they call me. If I'm unplugged, they know there's a couple of people that can call me, and only a couple of people, and that's it. And only if the place is burning down, you call me.
That's it. So Bailey's Pharmacies is Florida. I'm just going to go out of states. Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Texas. What are there other states?
We're currently looking to Chicago.
So Illinois.
And New York. We're going to open in New York soon.
I was wondering why not New York? Are you what type of analytics are you looking for when choosing the states? Is it population? Is it disabled population? Or what are you looking at to say, all right, we need to go here? Or maybe it might be a financial thing. There's a tax incentive for being in Florida, all right? There's no state tax in Texas. What types of things are you looking at?
So the main thing we look at is the number of Medicare lives.
Okay.
Which is the volume. How many people, which basically is telling me, how many people have used medical equipment and billed Medicare in the last 2, 3, 5 years? And based on those numbers, and then I also look at Medicare, straight Medicare, or MAP plans, which is Medicare replacement plans. If it's the Medicare replacement plans, it means that they are Blue Cross Blue Shield, United, Humana, different insurance plans. If it's straight Medicare, because the reason why I separate those two is because you have to be in network with the other MAP plans in order to bill them. Medicare, pretty much, if you open a medical business and you'll go through your license, your accreditations, you can bill Medicare. So that's a major part of, especially when I just enter a new state. Because if I go there, let's say they have 90% MAP plans, I only have 10% patients because I can't really bill the other private insurances because I'm not in network with them. So I look at the volume in which Medicare lives for the patients, and that's how I decide which area I want to be in.
So what's your plans for the future? Is it more businesses or just kind of focusing on what you have and just expanding that?
I think focusing on what I have now, I think my future goal is to be able to touch young women across the globe, to be able to help them, mentor them. Matter of fact, I was talking to a good friend last night and we were talking about me figuring out how to start a mentoring program given my crazy schedule so that the women are impacted, and not just women, men as well. They can learn the process, they learn the discipline and the structure so that they can take themselves from one stage of development to the next. So that's my calling and that's my gift. And that's where I'm that's the direction which I'm going.
Yeah. Talk about your philanthropy that you do.
Yeah, you alluded to that, but and I think it's important that you talk about the philanthropy, but because what you're doing, we don't see done. And we've had this conversation about when people leave a place or they leave a school, one of the best things you can do is give back, right? Whether it's from a booster or a donation to the school. And that's how we see endowments go up, right? Yeah. So I know that you've donated a lot, I think the largest sum in the history of the school. Yeah. Of UConn. Tell us why and what was the purpose of the goal was.
So I donated the largest amount in athletic history across all universities.
All universities, okay.
I did it to UConn because UConn gave me my first chance. They took a chance on me, a young girl from Hartford that didn't really have much and didn't even really know where I was going to go. But they took a chance on me, and that's the reason why I went back. But in conjunction to going back, I wanted the impact to be when they see a young Black girl or a Black boy, they give them the same level of grace that they do a white boy or white girl. And for that being is maybe they'll be Trisha Bailey. And believe it or not, even though I've shared this with UConn, that these are the reasons why I've talked to all the athletic directors across all the universities across the country. And I've shared that. This is why I've done my donation. And this month, I can proudly say that my University of Connecticut, I did not have a conversation with me about this. I'm just noticing their social media. They have chosen August to be Black Woman, highlight Black Woman in Philanthropy Month. And that makes me feel good because I believe the work that I'm doing and the work that I would like to continue to do, they have started and they're listening. And it's starting to make an impact, and I'm excited and happy for this future.
That's incredible. They named a wing. What did they build? They named something after you up there?
Yes. So the building is named Bailey Athletic Success Center, Bailey Student Athletic Success Center.
And what building is that?
That's the athletic building. So it includes 7 or 8 sports. It stretches about 2-3 blocks, and it's beautiful. I'm looking forward to the breaking ground. I think they're breaking ground in the next few months.
Good year for UConn. Yes, national champs.
Yes. And I told them we're going to be national champs, and everyone said, no, man. I'm like, we're going to be national champs because I said it.
Yeah. But yeah. Let's talk about Unbroken. You've waited your whole life for this moment to write this book, to tell your story, and talk about the importance of it and why you're doing it now.
So Unbroken. Unbroken is literally the name. Unbroken. I've gone through hell and back. Even in this success, I've gone through pain of being beaten at home, being abused, home's not safe, the street's not safe, trying to figure out how I'm going to survive, how I'm going to get to the next step, being a single mom, how to manage that, and how to build my career while I'm going through all the difficulties in which I am. Unbroken is raw from what everyone else who have read it. It's inspiring. It is. I read one review today, and the young lady who wrote the review said, I was so inspired. I was like, I'm going to go find a building. I don't know what I'm going to do with the building, but I'm just going to find one because I have to do something. And I felt good reading that because that's the impact that I wanted from people.
Yeah. So, I mean, even for, there's a financial literacy journey inside that. Obviously, you've learned lessons through it. What's one of the most important ones that you want, like, especially young adults? I feel like if we teach kids at a younger point in their lives, you know, the future trajectory for them is going to be greater. So, like, what's one of those things inside the book? I know you talk about the Junior Olympics being a major part in your financial literacy journey. Like, what's one lesson that you would impart on young people?
I think there's a few, not just one. So I think,
let's do it.
So the steps, God first, being disciplined. Financial literacy, and being kind, caring, and loving to every person that's around. That's what I want young people to know, that these are the steps. As long as you are direct with these steps, you can become successful and the doors will open for you. Now, being kind, loving, and caring, people just use that word as, okay, I just say a nice word to you. Well, it's not kind. For me, kind is a lot of things. Kind is me giving you a critique. Kind is me giving you a hand. Kind is me giving you a nice word. And kind sometimes is me telling you no, because that no gives you freedom to be able to venture out and do whatever else that you need to do, or don't do what I just told you no for, because that might not be the best direction for you.
It's a lot. Well, Dr. Triss, I've admired you since our phone call. As I'm sitting there thinking, a lot of the people who come from wealth in our community, we know their names. How do you feel about people not knowing your name? Or does it, I guess, from a standpoint where we know Oprah, we know Rihanna, right? We know these people from our culture that have ascended to this level of billionaire status. Are you okay with being kind of under the wraps and people learning out your story on their own?
Yes, I actually am. So I never had the desire of being in the public eye. Mm. The reason why I'm here with you now is because now the book, you know, the book is out. And the reason why I wrote the book is because I wanted it to be helpful and it to reach globally. And in order to do so, people actually have to know who I am, because there is autobiographies, read like an actual fictional novel, but it's an autobiography. Mm-hmm. And I said to my partner says, so what do you want to do? I said, I just want to sell books. And he says, okay, well, you're selling books. Some people got to have to know you to buy the books. So I was like, okay. So that's the reason why now people know who I am, and I'm allowing people to know who I am.
Yeah.
And because my journey is to help others.
Yeah. Well, my mom knew who you were.
She did.
She did. Oh, no. When I said, Mom, I'm going to do an interview. And I said, she's the wealthiest woman in Jamaica. And she wrote it on her little notepad because she watches like YouTube, mm-hmm. like this Jamaican YouTube. And you were on there and she wrote it down a couple of weeks ago. And I'm like, yeah, you don't know her. She's like, no. So I went downstairs to get my sneakers, come up. She's like, she ran track at UConn. I said, oh, yeah, that's her.
That is me.
I'm happy that for us, our people, especially our people, that you're telling your story and then we're getting to know you and about a field that, you know, we haven't really covered before, but there's somebody who has expertise and now they can inspire another person, another generation of people to say, like, this is something that's obtainable. This is, you know, the blueprint. Here are some steps I can take to actually pursue this. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And make sure you buy the book out now on Amazon.
Amazon. Yeah.
Anywhere else they can get it?
Just Amazon. Well, at my stores, you can, any one of Bailey's location have books, but those are the only two places that have them.
There you have it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Greatly appreciate it. And thank you guys for rocking with us. We'll see you next week.
I thought you were going to give us some patois.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about? Patois? You want to talk patois? Come on, man. You have to say something.
Put me on the spot.
It's like, I'll tell you, man.
You're done, though.
We'll take it. And shout out to Howie. He's over here. Shout out to him and the whole team, man. It's been a pleasure. And we all going, he's invited us to Jamaica. I don't know where we're going, but the first thing Howie said, yo, you come from yard. I was like, yeah, the family. He was like, we got to go back. Yeah, I said, whenever you're ready.
Yes, you have to.
Yeah.
So my beach house is done next summer, right? He's not in here. Yeah, next summer.
Done.
So you're definitely welcome. It's how big is it now? 42,000 square feet. it keep increasing.
I think my crew can fit there. Yeah.
Resort.
Yeah, I think I have a room for you.
Yeah, I think we can fit. Yeah. Yeah.
Resort. For sure. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.